This episode is brought to you by Fetch. Fetch is a kennel alternative right here in Denver, not a traditional doggy daycare or boarding school. They offer one-on-one private pet care for all kinds of pets, both furry and non-furry. And their employees are experienced, insured, bonded, and background checked, so you can rest easy knowing your pet is in good hands. Basically, they know pets. I used to watch a Burmese mountain dog named Sven, who was just like walking a polar bear. It was insane. Fetch offers pet sitting, dog walking, pet taxi, medication administration, and more. And he hated going on walks. I could like walk him around the block and then he was like, he just liked to lay in the bathtub. So if you're looking for high quality pet care you can trust, check out Fetch at northdenver.fetchpetcare.com. That's northdenver.fetchpetcare.com.
Today on CityCast Denver, two people were shot and killed at the transitional shelter in the old Doubletree in Central Park earlier this month, and city officials are still scrambling to beef up security. But who exactly is responsible? 9 News anchor Kyle Clark joins me and Bree to talk through the latest. Plus, Westminster is drowning in dog poop, and our wins and fails of the week. Today is Friday, March 29th. I'm Paul Caroli, and here's what Denver's talking about. Welcome back to CityCast Denver, the show about the number one pizza city in America.
Oh my God, Paul.
According to a new study.
This news was made for you, Paul.
You mean Yelp reviews and pizza
the aggregation
and
of data about yes. pizza in Denver? Yes.
Yeah, it's no surprise I went through the methodology on this one. But I have to say, I mean, this comes from some folks who may or may not want to sell you a nice new house in the suburbs. So obviously up front, like be skeptical.
Oh, is it one of those?
Yeah, this was flying around the internet these days. But I actually kind of thought it was legit. It was all about like, it was about Yelp reviews, which as we've talked about are about expectations. And then like what I really loved is Denver scored 82 out of 100 on our pizza passion metric, which measures how often locals are searching Google for pizza related terms, which is like, I think that's real, by the way. I think people here are searching for pizza and that's cool.
I was searching for pizza lovers last night.
Oh yeah?
Where'd you end up with? Because I didn't want to drive to Pizzeria Louie. I just ended up ordering something on Uber Eats instead. I didn't trust the pizza. I don't know.
Did you not go with, you didn't get a pie?
I didn't. Oh. I got poke. Sorry.
How was it?
It was fine.
Okay. It's Friday. We're here at the 5280 Magazine Studios. Our host, Bree Davies, is here, of course.
Hi.
Hey, and we've got a really exciting guest today. He's the host.
I'm so excited.
He's the host of Next with Kyle Clark on 9 News. Welcome to the show, Kyle Clark.
I'm so excited.
Kyle, what's your pizza take? What's your hot pizza take?
I would not put Denver in the top 50 pizza cities in America, but, you know, listen, why shouldn't we take all of our cues about what to think and believe by these clickbait surveys that come out?
You know, couldn't agree more.
I especially appreciate when it's like, you know, Denver, one of the 10 most violent cities, according to this stapler company, you know, it's like, if you say so, stapler company, I'm locking my doors.
I know. It's when, you know, I'm sure you guys get the press releases for these too.
All the time.
You're just like, what? But then we made a little story out of it, so they win.
Hey, they're fun to talk about. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, pizza's fun.
All right, let's get to our top story today, because this is an interesting one. It comes to us from year two of Mayor Mike Johnston's quest to end homelessness in Denver. Tragedy struck on March 16th at one of the mayor's new transitional shelters when someone armed with a gun entered the former Doubletree Hotel off I-70 in Quebec and shot and killed two people who were living there. Police are still investigating. They're looking for the culprit. Meanwhile, Kyle, your colleague at 9 News, Mark Salinger, reports that a member of city council, Chantel Lewis, is pointing the finger at the contractor in charge of the former hotel. Kyle, what exactly is the problem?
So the concern is whether the Salvation Army, which is operating the former Doubletree at Quebec and I-70, is doing enough to secure that facility. And actually this week, for the first time, after many weeks of trying, the folks in charge of the Salvation Army agreed to take our questions about this. And what they said is, listen, you've got folks who have got some real challenges in life. We've collected folks from encampments all over the city. They're all living in one place. Of course, you're going to have a concentration of problems in that place. That includes drug overdoses and acts of violence and things like that. They told us that some of the deaths were inevitable, which I think was at least unfortunate, right? At least unfortunate.
Yeah, that didn't sit with me well.
They also said that, and I understand where they're coming from, that they want those hotels to feel like a home and not a prison.
Right.
That meant that they were not checking who was coming in and out the doors. Mm. And that led to a situation where there were people coming in and out with all kinds of intent. Anyway, city got sick of this. City stepped in and, according to the mayor's office, told us that they went to Salvation Army and told them, we're taking over security here. Salvation Army tells a very different story, that they asked the city to come in and do security. The other thing that really caught my ear was when the Salvation Army acknowledged that they got $800,000 for security at that site, but did not spend more than a couple thousand dollars of it because they were researching options. I don't know how well that's going to sit with people when you have 7 deaths at the site while they researched security options, but on a go-forward basis, the city of Denver's taken over security. Now they've got guards at the doors and so forth.
Yeah, I heard Cole Chandler, I think, was talking about this. He's the head of what the mayor's now calling All In Mile High, his homelessness work. And Cole Chandler is saying that they're only going to let people in and out through the front door instead of having the side doors and stuff open. Bree, what do you make of this whole security situation at the DoubleTree?
I mean, I think you kind of spoke to this, Kyle, but this is a concentration of folks who are in trauma, in traumatic situations, coming out of traumatic situations. This is not your normal, I don't want to say normal, this is not just like an apartment building scenario. This is a lot of folks with severe issues. So I can see where there is a heightened alert for things happening. Preventable deaths, I don't know if those were not preventable. That feels a little, what was their wording?
Inevitable.
Inevitable.
Yeah, at least 2 appear to be a homicide.
Yeah, that doesn't feel, that did not sit right with me. Also, $800,000 for security, you were hired to run this place because you have a history of running places like this that the city is trusting that they're contracting this organization to do. What are they doing? Why are they sitting on $800,000? They should already kind of have a plan in place, I would assume.
Well,
it's not their first rodeo, is what I'm saying.
That's where we should drill down a little further. Because Kyle, you alluded to this, but I thought this was really interesting, the way they talked about their approach to security. Because the whole idea with these transitional housing sites is that it gives someone a platform to get their life back together, something that
stability.
Feels like a home.
Yeah.
And so when you start talking about security and putting more cops on the ground, like that doesn't feel like a home to me. But anyway, here's Nissan Kistan, divisional commander with the Salvation Army, talking about how they made their choices.
A lot of our facilities are not prisons. So they're not run like a prison. So people have the freedom to come and go. Mm-hmm. We're trying to help transform people's lives. We're trying to help people actually make their way forward. So in that sense, it's just like your home. When you have a home, you invite guests in, you engage with them.
I mean, I think I like that point. Sure, we don't want it to feel like a prison. I don't think anybody wants that. But maybe looking into some things like the co-responder program or the STAR program and having more folks on site who have eyes on the community that are more seen as part of the community might have been a solution.
Yeah,
I
talked to my guy. I have a source who's a case manager who works in this world. I won't be more specific than that, but I talked to him last night about this situation. His point was they're currently laying people off like crazy from these support systems because they're drawing down the support for newcomers in those different shelters. So those people who have the experience working with these populations, like there's fewer of those folks employed right now than ever, maybe making it feel a little bit more comfortable than a police officer who certainly is not going to be comfortable walking into that situation would. But Kyle, how do you feel like elected officials and like the administrators talk about this question about security versus like getting someone back on their feet and feeling comfortable?
So certainly Councilwoman Chantel Lewis has an outsized voice in this conversation, which I think she should because so many of these locations are in her district. She's not happy with the Salvation Army. She doesn't think that they have been a good partner. But this week, City Council advanced a new $8 million contract for the Salvation Army to run a family shelter down in the Hamden neighborhood in which the city will also be providing security. So it's clear that Councilwoman Lewis's concerns are not universally shared across council. And when I talked to the mayor's office about it, they were very clear to say, yes, we stepped in and told the Salvation Army we're taking over security, but they are a valued partner. We will be working with them going forward. Because I think the mayor's office probably looks at it as like, if we run off the Salvation Army, Who's waiting in the wings to do this? Who has the infrastructure to do this incredibly hard work that there are only a couple of organizations in town doing at scale?
There's another organization that I feel like is maybe increasingly popular or maybe increasingly attracting attention or resonating with folks. We were just talking about them this morning. Do Better Denver. Do you know this group, the Instagram account? They've been calling the DoubleTree the Trouble Tree. So the mayor is obviously looking at this sentiment rising as well, folks who are just don't want any part of this. I don't even know how to describe it. Kyle, how do you see that?
These are the anonymous people who go around and take videos of people in trauma and put them on the internet for clicks.
Exactly.
Image photos. Super classy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, like, how are you helping? How is that helping anyone? Like I understand to a certain extent they're trying to bring attention to a problem they feel like the city is not taking as seriously as they would like. But non-consensually filming people in the midst of trauma it's so inhumane to me that doesn't feel like there's a good reason behind it.
I mean, they say that they want to show people what's going on in Denver, right? So anybody who lives and works in the city knows what's going on in Denver. So what they're doing is they're showing people who don't venture into the city what it looks like in Denver. Those people don't have a say in what happens in Denver, right? They're not voters. They're not taxpayers. So at some point, it just becomes fear porn. And you look at the way that it's packaged, and it's always making a mockery of somebody who is hanging by a thread in life. And to do that with a mask over your face or a hood over your head as they choose to do it, I don't know. I have a tough time with that.
Well, that's interesting because I could see how some people might say the same thing about a story on Nine News about a double homicide at a shelter. You know, you're putting the same kind of information out there. You're telling the similar story. I wonder how you approach that at Nine News, talking about stories like this and not contributing to a narrative or maybe creating one.
Well, I mean, let's look at what that anonymous social media site does versus what news photojournalists do, right? Our goal is to protect people's dignity while also capturing their story. It's not to simply gawk at people in crisis and then put them up on the internet for clicks. So when we're dealing with vulnerable populations, if it requires taking a picture or taking a piece of video, our photojournalists are trying to make sure, how can we do that in a way that this person is not identified, that they're not exploited, that kind of thing. And they're very careful with those things, as opposed to intentionally, hey, let me pull over my car and take a picture of this person who may be in deep distress, because I bet you people in the suburbs will love that video.
Yeah, it feels a little... Anybody that's ever used social media knows what that feels like, to get clicks for doing something. Mm-hmm. And then you start doing it and you get more clicks and you get more likes and you get more attention. And then you wonder what's driving the reason you're doing it. But something I think that's interesting, Kyle, is you said people are not identifying people in the midst of crisis. I also think there's been a shift in media in the last 20 years to identify people as human beings when we're doing stories about unhoused folks. I've known, like Denverite, I would say, is a very good example of, they really try to talk to folks in a situation and get their name. They're not just nameless, faceless, homeless people. So I think that there's been some attention paid in media, if you're coming from a goodwill perspective versus the Do Better Denvers, of trying to humanize people. And there's a lot of dehumanization happening with the Do Better Denver account.
Yeah, I hope that that's the case, because when you stigmatize people or you refer to them as, you know, they're the homeless people or whatever else, it ignores everything else about their humanity, everything that's going on in their life, everything that happened in their life before they ended up in this situation, everything that could happen in their lives once they leave that situation. It's assigning people to a permanent underclass when you talk about folks like that. So I would hope that the media has made good progress on that.
Let's talk about Mayor Johnston a little bit more, because this was like a really big thing last year, I think. Like, we paid a lot of attention. It seemed to me like a lot of folks in the city were paying a lot of attention to his work on homelessness. It was his big priority. But since, I don't know, the end of the year, I feel like the attention has shifted other places. What do you all think the mayor's thinking about homelessness right now, Kyle?
I think he's got a lot of pots on the stove, right? I mean, I think the migrant crisis and the fact that the city is very intentionally trying to shift course on migrant services right now is occupying a lot of the city's time and attention, right? The mayor wants to scale down migrant services to bring more nonprofits into the fold while dealing with emergencies as they pop up. So I think that's a big focus. They're still trying to get hundreds of people off the streets and into temporary housing this year. I think you're going to hear more about that as the year goes on. But I think right now there's a lot of focus on the migrant crisis.
Bree, does it feel the same to you?
I would absolutely agree. I think Johnston was in campaign mode, and then he was in, okay, I've been elected. I've got to jump into it immediately and show a lot of what I've been talking about doing. And he's just deep in the muck now. He's in the midst of doing it. So it's not as glamorous, honestly, because we're not getting as excited about these spaces or these, you know, these sites opening or this quote progress being made because we're in the middle of it. It's the not interesting part.
I wonder.
It's the
about
dirty
that.
Work part to me. It's like you're down in the muck doing the dirt. Doing
I think
the work.
You're right about that. This is the dirty work part. The like
the not glamorous work, I would say. When I say dirty work, I mean the unglamorous right. aspect of it. Of the we're not just hopeful we're gonna do this. It's like we're actually having to do it now.
I might also say though, it also could be stalled.
True.
Progress could be stalled.
Big undertaking.
You buy or lease hotels, mm-hmm. you fill them with folks. You can't move in more folks until those folks move on to the next stage in their journey. And that's something that has been very difficult for us in the media to kind of track and quantify. And also, we've been paying a lot of attention to the migrant crisis as well. But to track how many people are making the step, not just into temporary housing, but then on into whatever kind of recovery or support that they need, on into different types of supportive housing. So that then opens up a unit for somebody else who's coming off the street. So I think one thing that we'll be looking at in the coming months is there actual forward progress being made as opposed to just sheltering people.
Right.
I think we kind of encountered that too when we were looking at the dashboard, mm-hmm. trying to figure out how they were quantifying how long people were in a space or if they were permanently or transitionally housed. And you're right. If once you house 1,000 people at once, it's a news event. As they trickle in and out of there, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's still working on it, clearly. And the Salvation Army is going to be a part of this somehow, because they do have this contract that the city council is going to be voting on soon, Kyle, like you mentioned. So we're going to keep watching this, how this develops, because I think that balance is really interesting. How much pressure does the Salvation Army take before they step back, or how's it going to develop? I'm just curious. If you have thoughts about what the mayor is working on when it comes to homelessness right now, we'd love to hear them. We'd love to hear your questions, your comments. The All In Mile High hotline is open. Text or leave us a voicemail at 720-500-5418. Again, that's 720-500-5418. All right, we're going to a break. We'll be back. All right, and we're back. Our hot topic this week is a really juicy one, guaranteed to make some folks out there pretty mad, especially dog people. The Westminster Hills Open Space, aka the biggest off-leash dog park in the metro area. Denverite reports this week that the city of Westminster has been dealing with so many issues with parking and poop that they're threatening to reduce the park from 420 acres to 20. Kyle, you're a dog owner.
I am.
Do you know this dog park?
I don't know that park particularly, but when I see all this pressure about whether they're going to shrink it, I wonder if we're asking the wrong question, and whether the better question is, why isn't Colorado just an off-leash dog park? Kind of like open container, but for dogs. Just wherever you want to be, you can be. I feel like maybe that's the direction we should go.
I think the answer is people don't know how to pick up after their dogs, Kyle, and that's why we're not there. This is the part that I'm a dog owner too. This part pisses me off. Just pick up after your dog. It's the mm-hmm. basic thing to do. And we've all been to a park where you just like roll up to a tree to sit down and there's a giant pile of dog shit. And you're like, okay, whose nanny didn't come after them? Like, whose mom is not behind them making sure they clean up after themselves? Like, this is where I feel for the city of Westminster a little bit. Because mm-hmm. this happened in Denver. The Rail Yard Dog Park got closed in 2017 because it was a biohazard site because there was so much poop. Because animals can't take care of themselves in this capacity. Mm-hmm. It's the human's job.
I always try to empathize with folks in situations like this and imagine like... you know, maybe someone got an important call, you
oh,
know,
please.
And they couldn't pick up their, but
I've
then
watched people do it. I'm sure you have too, Kyle. People just like letting their dog go and then walking away from it.
All of us has had the experience though, if you're walking your dog and you realize the container doesn't have a bag left in it.
I have gone back when that's happened. I have gone to my house, gotten a bag and gone back. I've also picked it up with Kleenex in my pocket.
You also make a show of it when you go back, though. You're walking down the street
like,
with a bag in the
me.
Air. Here I am. I'm back. Remember me, my dog. Here I am. I'm picking it up. I'm waving it in the air again. I'm a good neighbor. But no, the moment I realize that the bag is gone, you just
mortifying.
Flush with
yes.
shame. Your heart starts to beat. You're looking at the dog trying to gauge their inner workings of like, is this going to happen or not? It's the worst. So to think that there's people who are just free range letting their dogs defecate and walking away, I think these people are probably making other bad choices in life.
Yeah, I agree.
For the record, the data shows, the estimate from Westminster says they're paying to cart out 175 tons of dog waste per year from this dog park. So
good
that's a big number. But that's not the only issue. It's not just poop. It's also a very familiar Colorado issue, the overuse of the trails. This is a quote from the city. The park's popularity has led to the proliferation of informal social trails that have degraded the site's biodiversity and ecology. Despite expanding parking 6 times, illegal parking has become common, presenting public safety issues for pedestrians, et cetera, et cetera. Kyle, does that sound familiar to you?
I mean, it's a dog park, right? Like, we know how humans create desire paths through environments, and then dogs do that everywhere. I don't know why you would expect dogs to stay on trails.
I also just think that this screams, we need more dog parks.
I think so too.
I think
the demand is there.
The demand is there. Yeah. And they had one in my neighborhood in Barnum and they removed it and people freaked out. They removed it so they could put a pedestrian bridge over 6th Avenue. It's not for nothing. It made a lot of difference, but they didn't replace it anywhere. And so
yeah,
people like me would probably drive to Westminster to go to this dog park, especially folks with bigger dogs that need more space. I have a tiny dog that just, well, he hangs out in my yard and chases people, but that's a whole other story. I'm an irresponsible dog owner in that sense. But there needs to be more places around the city.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
it can't be Westminster's job.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I will say though, I thought that the tell in that Denverite article by Kyle Harris was the community member who said, "I've got a group of people who are willing to go out and pick up the poop." And that apparently was not satisfactory to the city.
Really?
Want to know more about that, because if there is this legion of goodwill poop picker-uppers that are ready to solve that problem, then I think the problem is actually something else. I think it's probably parking. I think it's probably mm-hmm. the
That's
degradation of the environment, because I saw the community member saying, we'll handle the poop issue. That's going to be a lot of volunteers for that many, metric tons of
175.
Excrement.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah. But they were willing to do it. Why not let them?
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, volunteers picking up poop. How sustainable of a system is that for a big facility like this?
It's a lot of space.
Kyle, are you a dog park person in general?
I'm not a dog park person. I think probably just because I'm overly sensitive to litigation. Our
you
dog is
dog
also
to...
new. Next week, she celebrates 1 year with our house.
Oh,
she's a shelter dog that we adopted, and she's just the sweetest. She's a little skittish around other dogs, and for that reason, we try not to have uncontrolled encounters. And yay, litigation. You know?
Yeah. No, it is hard. You don't know how your dog's going to behave. Even if you have a really well-behaved dog, another dog can trigger them to do. It's complicated.
I was reading about this yesterday. I'm not really a dog person, but I was just seeing like the experts are divided on the benefits of dog parks generally. Like some people are saying it's like really bad for some dogs.
What?
Like you get vulnerable dogs. Yeah, dangerous.
But where do they go to be dogs? You know, a lot of folks don't have yards, right? Especially as we talk about density and things like this. There's less and less yard space. You got to have your dog. They've got to have somewhere to go.
I bet those experts are humans.
Maybe.
No one's asking the dogs about this. What do the dogs want? Here's another idea. This is from one of the residents that Kyle Harris quoted in his story, Tom Thorpe. Thorpe proposed, why don't we have some kind of fee for non-Westminster residents to use the dog park? Bree, what is that? How does that sound to you?
I feel like we do that for a lot of things. There's a lot of things that are open to residents at a different price. I mean, rec centers. I know sometimes we go to a different rec center in Lakewood, and we're not Lakewood residents, so we pay a little bit more. I don't know if I'd necessarily be opposed to that if it meant that the park was kept up and safe and that money went to something. Maybe.
That feels fair. I mean, yeah. If people from other places want to use an amenity that's subsidized by taxpayers someplace else, that seems fair. You'd want to know how it would be managed.
Right.
You know, it feels like the easy way to do it would be a parking pass, and then you're encouraging people to only come there by vehicle. But if they're coming from out of the immediate area, that's probably how they're getting there.
This comment gave me an idea, which is like maybe this isn't a government problem to solve. Like maybe there should be some enterprising individual buy up some land and make the most, like the world's best dog park, because then you could charge bucco bucks for folks that want to go have a premium experience for their dog.
You want to privatize our dog parks?
I'm saying
Paul loves privatizing things. Like, well, it's kind of like the dog bar, the watering bowl by your house, Paul.
Is that open?
I don't know if it's still open. I mean, I know you're not like a real big fan of dogs, so you're not hanging out there. But yeah, I don't love the privatization idea, but you're not wrong.
Someone could like it. Some people would like it. I don't know what amenities would be there. I don't know what it would look like, but it's a possibility.
There probably wouldn't be poop on the ground. That would be a benefit for
that
everyone.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the city of Westminster has not decided what to do yet about this particular place, if anything. So send us your dog park takes now before they do. Weigh in. Let us know what you think.
If you're a person that doesn't pick up your dog poop, please send me a message anonymously if you want to. I want to know your reasoning. What's your deal? Why do you do that? That's my question.
Yeah, and it's also okay if it happened once. We forgive you. It's fine. We'd like to know. So 720-500-5418 is the number. Colin, let us know what you think about dog parks. Time for one more break, and then wins and fails. All right, we're back. Hey, it's the end of the week. It's the best way to do it. Here with us, wins and fails, aka Rocky Mountain highs and lows. Each of us has brought a recent local something that we think is a fail and another we think is a win, and we're going to talk about them. So let's do fails first, and Bree.
Curious Theater is in peril. It needs money. They need $250,000 by July to keep functioning. This is a small independent theater company here in Denver. That's based in the Golden Triangle in a beautiful little old church. And they're just really struggling, like many arts organizations post-pandemic. Ticket sales are not enough. They did sort of a ticket subscription model so that they're really dedicated fans. But that only provides about a third of their income. And they're in an older building that needs upkeep. They've got a lot on their plate. But I just like to remind people that the curious theaters of the world are how we get to the DCPAs of the world. We have to have those beginning places where people can try out things, whether that's the audience or the artists. They need a place to experiment. And these are fully formed productions. This is not to say these are not professional productions, but they're things that you're not going to see on a bigger stage yet. So they have to germinate somewhere. They have to do, this is often where more political stuff happens on stage, where conversations are a little bit more intense through the art. And curious theater has been here for a really long time, and it's so important. And I just worry when these kinds of things happen, like losing a curious theater would mean losing, you know, a couple decades of institutional knowledge too about theater and about Denver. And we need that to continue on. And this story just bummed me out. I really care about curious theater and that era, that level of artistry is just so crucial to what makes Denver great. So
Kyle, you know Curious Theater?
I don't know Curious Theater, but I do worry about what's going to happen to a lot of smaller nonprofits, both in the arts and outside, as pandemic stimulus money dries up and cities are tightening up budgets and things like that. I think it's just going to be a brutal couple of years for small organizations that serve the community in so many ways that often maybe outside that niche aren't very well known, but are so important to folks in the community, and they're going to be in really, really tough straits for a while.
Yeah. I remember reading something or hearing something about Curious Theater having like a leadership transition recently. So it might be like a particular situation with this group.
Yeah, I didn't dig too much into that, but I think the pandemic thing is the biggest part. It's like we took these massive hits. There was some support. As it goes away, like you said, they're tightening budgets. We're seeing that all over the place. Arts are often the first thing to go, even though they're so crucial to how we operate as a society. It's how we process our world. So
I did see a play there. Well, no, it wasn't a play. It was like a staged reading. It was beautiful. It was like a staged reading of this, I think it was, maybe it was a play from the 30s or something about some radical communist candidate for office in upstate New York. And it was like a 4-hour long reading. So it was a slog, but it was like, it was pretty out there. It was a cool thing that was happening. I was glad to be able to see it.
And like, if one person in that room is inspired by that to go on and do something else, then they be, you know, they can often become the thing that you do end up knowing on Broadway or whatever. But it has to have that place to have that experience happen in the first place.
Beautiful building too. Kyle, what's your fail this week?
My fail for this week is the collapse of the City of Denver's Entrepreneurship Fund for Women and BIPOC-owned businesses. Mm. This came out of nowhere. So this was a fund that was set up with cannabis tax dollars. The intent was $15 million over 3 years, and it was a really unique setup that was designed to basically allow the city to invest through a venture capital firm into small businesses owned by women and people of color. And it got some press when it got launched. It was an innovative concept, and it appears to have just come apart at the seams in its first year in existence. And now the businesswoman who is running the fund for the city is suing the City of Denver, saying that the city has failed to reimburse her for $800,000 in expenses and has basically told her there's no more money left. This is over. The city is making accusations at her that she doesn't have proper receipts and documentation for millions of dollars in spending and that they're sitting on $1 million in cash that should have gone to these small businesses. I've been reporting on this for about a week now. I can't sort out what exactly happened, but what we know is that the city had this great intention to help these businesses, and it's just come apart in acrimony and now legal back and forth. And it's just a shame, and it makes you wonder if the city is going to hesitate to go down this road again, because the setup to put it together was unique and a little complicated, and now it's gone up in flames.
We're going to have to talk a little bit about this, because this dovetails with my fail as well. And I have a theory. Would love to hear what you think about this. Pot sales are down precipitously ever since 2020. So these tax revenues that they were maybe counting on to fund this program, were they not there?
I think that that's a very good point. And I've asked everybody involved, how much money is left in the bucket, right? What's in the bucket? And if you talk to the folks who are running the fund, they say, the city told us that they were down to a couple thousand dollars, that the bucket was dry. The city tells us, no, there's millions of dollars left, and we need to see the receipts before we'll do reimbursements. So there's a big discrepancy between how much money is in there. It's certainly less than they originally thought. You're totally right about pot revenues coming down, therefore tax revenue coming down. So it's never going to be the $15 million over 3 years that they had initially expected. But is the well dry? The city says no. The fund says yes.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
I just worry about the long-term impacts of we can't change massive structures to start supporting women-owned businesses and people of color-owned businesses just out of nowhere. So this was a start to try to do that. And I worry when these kinds of things happen that it makes cities and other organizations skittish of trying it again. So will there be long-term impacts for these kinds of ideas and projects to go forward?
I think it's a very fair question. And if you talk to the woman who was running the fund, who's a local venture capitalist, she has projects outside of running this fund for the city. She takes great offense at the city publicly saying that she did not have the right documentation and receipts. And she'll say, you know, as a black woman in finance for 15 years, my reputation is everything. And the city saying this can ruin my life. And now it's going to play out in court.
Wow. Wow. What an unfortunate situation. The weed sales thing, like, I feel like there's something about this, and this is another one of my hobby horses, but the way that we pass taxes here, like the fact that this fund was reliant on weed taxes at all and wasn't just like the city saying, if we want to have this fund, we should just fund this fund. We should have a reliable, consistent funding source just as part of our budget. But instead, and I know why they do this, because it's easier to get people on board if you tax something that is seen as immoral, like weed. So that's the way we do it. And then we put ourselves in these situations where the thing that you wanted is totally reliant on this completely unrelated industry, weed.
And that's kind of when I think these things aren't taken as seriously as they should be, in that, like, why can't we find a more dedicated funding stream? Why isn't this a bigger priority or importance for the city?
Yeah, if we cared enough about it to set it up and to do it, why not fund it properly?
Yeah. Paul, did you want to say more about your fail then?
Yeah, well, no, it is a perfect segue because mine is also stemming from the weed sales plummeting. They're down to what looks to me like 2018 levels of weed sales right now. So the whole narrative that we once talked to Ricardo Baca, the founding editor of Cannabis and now the Grasslands PR agency, he was like, this is a pandemic thing. People are smoking weed like crazy during the pandemic, but we're going to see it go back down to pre-pandemic levels. Doesn't seem to be the right. We're down to 2018 levels. But what it's doing is warehouse space, industrial warehouse space, because these companies aren't selling the amount of weed that they had been.
They're sitting on real estate.
They're sitting on real estate, or they're going out of business and leaving real estate empty. And apparently, it's really difficult and expensive to convert warehouse space from marijuana grows.
Because everything stinks.
Yeah.
I lived in a grow, I'll tell you.
Could you grow mushrooms?
I don't know. Maybe that's next.
That's a good question. Maybe that's the next thing. Because I was like, are people just smoking less weed? Or there is a huge movement towards sobriety.
For sure.
So, and I know there's a lot of definitions of sobriety, but maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's also like the neighboring states all coming on board, legalizing. So we're getting less pot tourism. That's another good theory that I've heard.
I got to say, neighborhoods like mine are probably a little happy, though, that we aren't going to be having those smells like weed over here all the time kind of situation.
I'm sure some people are cheering this on as it's happening. But for the folks in the industry, it's probably really terrifying.
Also, it may be hard to change the function of a building from being a grow or whatever, but it's Denver. Someone will find a way. Real estate sells itself.
somebody's going to love it. You know, that's going to be the ambiance.
That's
you know?
The immersive mm-hmm. experience.
Yeah. That was a story from Business Den, by the way. So let's move on to wins. Let's do some wins. Kyle, do you want to give us your win?
Sure. My win for the week, my Rocky Mountain High, is that Vine Street Pub and Brewery is reopening after 4 years.
Love this place. So I'm with you, Kyle.
It's such a cool place in Uptown. If folks aren't familiar, it's partnered with the Mountain Sun folks out of Boulder, but it's great beer. It's great food. It's such a chill place to be, except if you tried to pay with a credit card. You couldn't do that. Although when they come back, they're going to let you pay with a credit card. But they are?
They are.
It's huge.
They are.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like that model because like you could just like not pay and then come back and pay more if you wanted. They had a system.
The
they had an envelope.
The
karma envelopes.
What are you talking about? What is a karma envelope?
Like if you didn't have cash at that moment, other people might pay more for you or you could come back. Okay. And they were still in business. So
yeah,
but it was smart of them to make that transition.
I'm just so excited because there were so many things, right, that we lost during the pandemic.
So many.
I think most people think that we've gotten back everything that we're going to get back. So to see something come back after 4 years, this sounds silly, but it was almost emotional. Like you thought this place was gone. It had been gone for 4 years. And as somebody who lives on that side of town and drives by it all the time, you'd remember great times there. You know, you'd remember sitting out on the patio to have brunch on a beautiful day or, you know, grabbing a beer after work because they were open late. And it was just such a great place to be. And to have that come back and to get something back that we lost in 2020 is just so immensely cool.
And rare. That's really rare. Oh, I love the big, tall wooden booths. Oh, they have this beautiful carpet. I don't know how to explain it.
It's warm.
It's warm. Yeah.
I remember going a couple of times and just having a blast. It was comfortable immediately as soon as you walked in the door.
Yeah. And we need more of that. We don't have enough restaurants like that, I think, at this point in time. There's too much pretentiousness happening and we're missing the place where you can walk in and just go, oh, okay, I feel great. My only request, they don't serve the root beer that they make at Mountain Sun like on tap at Vine Street. And I would love for them to bring it to Vine Street because I love their root beer. So just a request.
Okay.
Just a mild request. Paul, do you want to go?
Yes, I do. This is maybe a small one, but I've been biking a little bit more as the weather's been getting nice. So I'm back on my favorite Cherry Creek Trail. And there's some new art that's been going up lately. The city's public art program, they're refreshing the walls a little bit, but there's cool new stuff. There's some that I don't always love, but there's some really cool like cartoon characters down there now. Like this anthropomorphic bug is a standout. He's like next to a drainage ditch and they give him a fishing rod.
I like when the art interacts with the structure that it's on. You know what I mean? Like it's a cool acknowledge or just like, I don't know. It makes it a little bit more fun to look at. But it also means, Paul, that a piece of art on that trail that you did not like is gone.
We can talk about that one too. I wasn't sure if I wanted to.
I don't want to put you on blast. We don't have to say which piece, but you didn't like it and it's gone now.
We should talk about it because I'm sure other people feel the same way. And it got tagged constantly, but Denver Rules Everything Around Me was the name of it by Nigel Penhale. Do you know this one, Kyle?
I don't know. I've probably run by it, but I don't know.
Bright yellow. It was very graphic design-y, just like big words. Yeah. I can't remember
what. It's kind of generic like Denver phrases, like, you know, crush the pow. But like in a square, a red and yellow square.
So kind of like the thing that you would expect like a corporate chain to pay for on the side of their building downtown and not perhaps in a public space. Okay.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah, it didn't fit. It didn't necessarily fit with the vibe of the other paintings, I would think.
Yeah, and it got tagged all the time. So I'm sure it was expensive to keep it up and they painted over it. So it looks like we're going to have some space.
No
for,
shade. I
for
know,
something
Nigel.
New.
No shade, Nigel. It's just, you know, you've done other pieces. So.
Anyway, Cherry Creek Trail, it's looking great. It's looking great this spring.
I hope they add more. There's tons of space.
I do too. Fill it all up.
It makes it cool whether you're like biking or walking down it or if just passing by it in your car. Just like, it looks really beautiful. Mm-hmm. So, nice.
Bree, your win?
The city is putting $2 million more to the Basic Income Project. This is a project that gives folks who are unhoused or in housing transition cash every month. To do what they need to do with it. And I think if any of us know anything about living in this world, sometimes that's your mortgage. Sometimes that's a medical bill. Sometimes that's new tires for your car. Sometimes that's just groceries. And they found that it was successful in part to keeping people housed, and they're going to keep doing it. And I think it's awesome.
I love that it's being intensely studied though, right?
Because
that's part of the deal.
We need to know why. What is it doing? How does this work? Because I understand you don't just give cash to anybody. I mean, I'd love them to give cash to me, whatever. But like seeing how it gets used or how it affects people is helpful for future programs too.
Yeah, I just think there's so much skepticism about the idea of giving people money and allowing them to use it for whatever they see fit. The fact that we're able to do it in a controlled environment where it's really heavily studied, that's going to be fantastic because now other organizations and municipalities can look at that model and have some evidence. And for people who like to live in an evidence-based world, you can put evidence in front of them. Some people not a fan of evidence, but for folks who like evidence, you can put it in front of them.
No, that's a fair point. Yeah, I have a friend that works with folks with traumatic brain injuries who struggle with you know, like just signing up for their Social Security, doing the basic things in life. And this kind of thing helps them so much in a way that like they don't have to jump through a bunch of hoops to get it. They are, again, being studied and they're part of a program and you can't apply to it right now. But there's just more ways and more opportunities to get folks on their feet and help them feel, I don't know, safe and secure in the city. I love it.
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should find some of the folks who are beneficiaries of this. I'd like to hear how they're feeling.
Yeah, how they feel about it,
and like what the reporting is like for them, because all that data is like really nice to have if you're assessing the program, the policy.
It probably takes a lot.
But I wonder if it feels intrusive or like a burden to track your budget and report it to some, you know, some nerds somewhere crunching numbers. I don't know who's doing it.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point, Paul.
Well, three wins, three fails.
We did it.
Big week.
We did it.
Lots of highs and lows.
Yeah.
And here we are at the end of the show.
Awesome. This is it.
I'm just going to sit in it for a second, I guess. I don't know. I don't want it to be over. Kyle, it's been so fun.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here. I love listening, and it was even more fun to be here in person.
Thank you, Kyle. Thanks, Paul.
See y'all next time. That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. Our producers this week were Olivia Jewel Love and me, Paul Caroli. Peyton Garcia writes our morning newsletter, Hey Denver, with help this week from Natalia Aldana. Bree Davies is our host. Our music is by Los Mocochetes, with additional mixing by Tyler Lindgren. If you haven't already, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, follow us on Instagram at CityCast Denver, and tell the folks at the Vine Street Pub about us the next time you're in. You can sign up for that daily newsletter I mentioned and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. See you next week.
I'm not a cat person, so I can't judge.
Oh, well, you're in a room full of cat people over there. All of these people, cat people. Extreme cat people,
too. I try not to vocalize that. It's dangerous.